Parsha of Korach, undoubtedly one of the most complicated parshas, specifically because it is clear that when we come to discuss the question of Korach, to understand the psukim that essentially take up the first half of the parsha and more, we need to appreciate that there are already two separate questions that need to be addressed. Number one, what does Korach want? And number two, what is Korach saying? And we understand that the two questions are not the same. And the answer to them is not identical. In that the answer to the first question as to what motivates Korach is one of the less pleasant aspects of human nature. It's been identified for us by Chazal, although in a somewhat rarefied form. And Korach was a great person, but he was jealous of the Nasius, of the fact that Eltsofen ben Uziel had been appointed the Nasi of the family of Kehos. And no one is immune to jealousy. Akina v'ataiva v'akovod motzien es ha'odim in the olam. And Korach is the human example of kina causing a person to exit the world. So there is no sophisticated answer to the question as to what motivated Korach. The answer to that question is unbearably simple. But of course, what Korach says will not be about that. He attracted, after all, a very respectable following. The 250 people that attached themselves to Korach were people of high caliber. And the Torah talks about them, Nisiei Moed, Kriyei Moed, Nisiei Edo, Anshei Shem, which means Korach must have said something that ignited a very positive initiative within these people, even if it was misguided and out of bounds. But he certainly did not go to them and say, I'm looking to rebel against Moshe because I'd like to be the Nasi of B'nai Kehos, who's with me? Because that is not how a person gets a following. And therefore, we understand that with Korach, what you see is not what you get. What he is claiming and what he is remonstrating with Moshe is not really what it's about at all. And now the question is, what does he say to Moshe? There are a number of statements of Chazal that need to be taken into account in order to get a fuller picture as to at least one approach to what Korach is saying. There is a medrash. It's called a medrash pliya, a wondrous medrash, and we'll see why instantly. The medrash asks the question, Mara'a Korach? And here is Korach, he's instigating the rebellion against Moshe. Mara'a, what did he see? Meaning, what got him going? At least in terms of the scholarly confrontation with Moshe. And the answer, says the Medrash, is Para Aduma Ra'a. Most people, as they enter into Machlokas, they stam see red. Korach saw the red cow. Para Aduma Ra'a. And of course, Medrash Pliya. Ein ha-medrash hazeh omer ela darsheni. As we know very little about the paraduma, even at the best of times, and certainly as the motivation for a Korach and paraduma, and he's off. What did he see in the paraduma? Now, as we know, Korach had a number of questions for Moshe. It took the form of a Dvar Torah exchange. He asked with the Shaila of Tzitzis, and in fact that is an aspect of Smichus Parshius. For the beginning of Korach follows on the very end of Shalach. The final item discussed at the end of Parsha Shalach is Tzitzis. And Vayika Korach. And some say Vayika Korach is Tzitzis. That was the first of his questions. He took his 250 men. He had them dressed in garments entirely made of Tcheles. And now he has a Shaila. for Moshe Rabbeinu. A garment made completely of tacheles. Does that garment need tzitzis? So Moshe says, yes, any four-corner garment needs tzitzis. And now Korach, of course, responds and says, well, if the entire garment is made of the other colors, and two or three or however many of the eight strings of tcheles will exempt and will cover the garment, so if the entire thing is made of tcheles, so how much more? So it should be fine and it shouldn't need the tzitzis. And then he proceeds and has a second question. A house that is entirely filled with Sifrei Torah, does it need a mezuzah? It's good china. Well, the answer is, yes, every house needs a mezuzah. Once again, Korach gets going. If a house that's full of mundane objects and two paragraphs written on the door are enough for the house, so if the entire house is filled with Sifrei Torah, which is a mezuzah many times over, so certainly it shouldn't need a mezuzah on the door. Isn't that correct? Doesn't that make sense? These two questions are quite well known as the questions of Korach. There is a third, actually, which is quite similar in form. Korach's third question, mentioned by the Medrash, is if a person has tzaras, and the tzaras covers the entire person, what is his status? Is he tamei as a metzora, or is he tahor? And Moshe said, of course, the halacha is, the pasuk tells us, kulo hafach lavan tahor. If he's entirely white, he's tahor. And Korach, we're familiar with the template already. And Korach says, well, how can that be? If most of it, the more tzaras he has, the more tamei he should become. So if he's completely metzora, he should be completely tamei, or if there is such a concept, or at the very least, tamei. And you say he's tahor, how can it be? And these are the famous three kashas of Korach. And the question that we need to ask is, what exactly is Korach looking to achieve by raising these questions? What is his agenda? The answer, on a simple level, is that he's looking to make a mockery of the Torah. As if to say, if this is not logical, then that's further confirmation of what he's claiming, that Moshe has been making things up. Even though, number one, he must know that if Moshe were to make up the Torah, presumably when people make things up, they make them up with maximum credibility. He would not have made them up with these backward-bending curves. Moreover, Korach must also know that the fact that the real Torah, which is divine, one cannot expect everything about it to make sense to the human mind. Which means as grounds for mockery, it yet needs to be understood. I mean, what did he discover? He discovered that the rules of the Torah do not always follow the way that you would have written the Torah. Well, that may well very well be because they were written by God. But Korach seems quite happy with these questions, certainly as a launch for his machlokes. There is a statement of the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin. Daf Kuf Yud Amud Aleph, there in Perek Chelek, it discusses many aspects of Korach. And amongst the things that it says, there is a statement there which certainly requires understanding. As part of the charge of Korach against Moshe Rabbeinu, says the Gemara, Melamed shechashduhu be'eshes ish. They suspected Moshe, or accused Moshe, they held him suspect with regards to eshes ish, a married woman. And that certainly needs to be understood. What does the Gemara mean to tell us? Shechashduhu be'eshes ish. But who can suspect Moshe Rabbeinu of such a thing? From his own wife even separated. Everybody knows that Moshe Rabbeinu is a tzaddik. Melamed shechashduhu be'eshes ish. Now, the test that Moshe prescribes for anyone who wishes to prove themselves as the would-be Kohen, let him step forward. Kol dichvin yeseh v'yechol. You want to try? Try. Take the Keteres, and tomorrow morning we'll meet. Now, according to the Rishonim, at that time, when everybody brought the Keteres, I mean, where is the Keteres typically brought? In the building of the Mishkan, and which is where Aaron brought it, because that's where he brought it every morning. The other 250 men did not bring the Keteres in the Mishkan. I mean, there is no room for 250 people in the Mishkan. And they all brought it at the same time, which means that these other 250 men are actually bringing their Keteres in the wrong place. I mean, they're off location. They have no choice. But if that's true, then we need to understand how this is fair. Because the Keteres has to be brought in a specific location in order to work, that we know. And of the 251 candidates, only one of them is allowed to bring it in the right place. So the other 250 don't really sound like they have a fighting chance. They seem doomed from the beginning. Because here is the contest, and only Aaron is allowed to do it right. And you all have to do it in the wrong way, and off you go. But that's what it sounds like. Now, the general approach, which is taken by a number of Mefarshim, is that Korach is really arguing with Moshe about the implications and the fallout for the Jewish people of the Chet HaEgel. In other words, when the Egel happened, things changed. And really, Korach's charge, Ki kol ha'edo kulam kadoshim. Everyone's kadosh, everyone's holy. I mean, that's certainly going to gain him votes. And that's his platform. The entire Jewish people are holy, which they are. But Korach's point is, and therefore we don't need specifically Kohanim. Anyone can do the Avodah. Now, where does he get such an idea from? Well, it happens to be that, from a certain point of view, he's right. At least historically. Because before the Chet HaEgel, that was how it was. The Bechor of every family represented that family in the Avodah. And in a sense, therefore, Korach is saying that as surely as we've seen it happen, that's how it should be now. And should we ask the question, well, in the meanwhile, in the interim, the Jewish people fell. They fell from grace. They did the Egel. So things have changed. Say the Mefarshim, yes, things did change. Korach is claiming that they should be able to change back. In other words, the move of Korach is that Moshe Rabbeinu is artificially, unnecessarily, keeping the Jewish people in the post-Egel state. They should be able, by this stage, to have been rehabilitated to the extent that they could go back to how it was. But Moshe's keeping them in the Bidyeved situation. And the reason why is very simple. The Chet HaEgel, at least as a matter of principle, has been atoned for. If that's true, then if the confiscation of the Avodah from the Bechorim is in the wake of the Egel, but having recovered from the Egel, so the Avodah should revert to the Bechorim. And what's interesting is, this gives a different intonation to Korach's words. The first thing he says, the first two words that he says to Moshe, is in the beginning of the Parsha, Perek Tetzayin, Pasuk Gimel, Vayikohalu al Moshe va'al Haron, the whole group gets together to Moshe and Aaron, Vayomu alehem, Rav Lochem. Rav Lochem. What is the meaning of Rav Lachem? Rav Lachem means too much or enough. Enough what? Too much what? So these Mefarshim explain that although the simple understanding is that you've taken too much for yourselves, but Rav Lachem means that you've kept the situation going for too long. Rav Lachem, it's enough already. Because ultimately, kol ha'edo kulam kadoshim. And they should be back on their feet, and their voters should be returned to them. And this is the biur in the Medrash, which asks the question, ma ra'a? What did Korach see? Para aduma ra'a. We don't know that much about the paraduma, it's a chok. But we do know that the paraduma represents the kapara for the chet ha'egel. Let the mother come and clean up the mess of the child. And therefore, having been given the para aduma, which signals the fact that fundamentally the Jewish people, the mess of the egel has been cleared up. So Korach says, para aduma, we're back in play. The egel is history. So we should recover from its effects and give the avoda back to the people. That's the meaning of the Medrash, para aduma ra. And here, Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz continues and says something which is most fascinating. So far we've said that Korach is claiming to Moshe that perhaps the Jewish people fell, but they should be able to get up again by now. And we want the Avoda back. Emboldened by that, it could be that Korach is actually taking this further, saying not only should the situation revert to how it was before the Egel, even though it changed, it should change back, Korach is then claiming that perhaps things never needed to change in the first place. He is now accusing Moshe that even the disaster and the fallout of the Egel didn't have to have happened. Now, how can he say that? What does that mean? So let's see. Moshe's response to seeing the Chet HaEgel was to break the Luchos. Now, in breaking the Luchos, Moshe fundamentally compromised or detached the Jewish people in terms of their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He stalled their progress. And the question is, why did he do that? And there are two classic answers given by Chazal as to what prompted Moshe, so to speak, to break the Luchos. The first is to be found in the Medrash Tanchuma, which says that Avodah Zarah, as we appreciate, if the Jewish people, their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu was like a husband and wife. Kim sos choson al kala, yosos alayach elokayach. And to that end, if the Jewish people, if they their allegiance is diverted elsewhere to another would-be deity, within the context of that relationship, Avodah Zarah always has an aspect of adultery because they're violating the exclusive relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, as we know, the penalty for such a relationship is much more severe when those in question are actually married as opposed to just on the way or both single. Moshe is looking to detach the Jewish people's relationship fundamentally or significantly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In the words of the Tanchuma, Mutav sheyidonu kepnuya. Let them at least be considered as if they're not married, as if they're single. Now, Avodah Zarah is worse enough, but not to add insult to injury. It's not in their interest now to have the full relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu because they're violating it. Better to dissolve the relationship to mitigate on their behalf. Mutav sheyidonu kepnuya, va'yidonu ke'eshes ish. That they'll not be considered to be fully married, so to speak, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because that will make things infinitely worse. And what does Korach say? Korach is now claiming, and this is, it's the chutzpah of Korach. He claims that Moshe Rabbeinu did not need to sever the relationship in order to save the Jewish people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love for the Jewish people was strong enough that even if Moshe had not broken the luchos, which set in motion all of these cosmic reverberations, and they lost the avodah and everything, even if you hadn't broken the luchos, we'd be fine. You overreacted. You did not appreciate, or you underestimated the depth of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love for the Jewish people in terms of that relationship, and you had to sever the relationship, but the reality was it was an unnecessary move. You didn't need to break the luchos, and none of this needed to have happened. So here is Korach championing the cause of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love for the Bnei Yisrael. We would have weathered the storm. You didn't have to ruin things. And that, says Rabbi Yonasan Eibershitz, is the biur in what the Gemara says, melamed shechashduhu be'eshes ish. They were suspicious of Moshe. They held him suspect with regards to a married woman. Which married woman? The Jewish people are the married woman. They are married to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And they suspected Moshe, and that they aroused that suspicion that he unnecessarily compromised that relationship. We were happily married. We went through a bit of a rough patch called the Chet HaEgel. We could have weathered it. And you ruined our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Malam and Shechashdu Be'eshes Ish. These are very deep accusations. And moreover, see, there is another explanation as to what moved Moshe to break the luchos, which once again had all of these ramifications. The Talmud tells us in Masechet Shabbos, in the ninth perek in Daf Peches, Moshe Rabbeinu, he saw the Jewish people involved in what's essentially Avodah Zarah by that stage, and he made a kal v'chomer. If Korban Pesach, which is only one of the 613 mitzvahs, a person who is involved in Avodah Zarah is barred from it. Kol ben nechar leyocha bo, anyone who is estranged through Avodah Zarah is not allowed to eat the Korban Pesach. So Kal Vachomer, they're about to receive the entire Torah, it's too much for them if they're involved in Avodah Zarah. Kal Vachomer, and he broke the luchos. That is the second classic explanation as to why Moshe broke the luchos, as to be found in the Gemara. And now, says Rabbi Yonasan Eibershitz, let us look again at the questions that Korach asks Moshe. Number one, a garment which is entirely tcheles. Does it need tzitzis? Does it need tcheles? The answer is, yes, it does. And Korach says, well, I mean, it shouldn't. If none of it was tcheles, three threads would be fine, four threads would be fine. If the whole thing is tcheles, certainly it would be fine. That was question number one. Question number two, the entire house is full of Sifrei Torah. Does it need a mezuzah? Says Moshe, yes. But it shouldn't need a mezuzah, says Korah. I mean, the whole thing is full of Sifrei Torah. And number three, the entire person is a mitzorah. Is he? What is his status? Says Moshe, tahor. Korah says, well, kavachomer should be tami. So our question was, what is Korah looking to do here? It sounds like he's looking to undermine the halachas of the Torah, but sometimes the halacha is beyond you. What does he mean to say? He's looking to reject Moshe's answers? Says Rabbi Yonasan Eibershitz, no. He's looking to use Moshe's answers against him. How so? See, what these three questions have in common is, all of them, in principle, involve a kal v'chomer. And ultimately, the kal v'chomer does not carry the day. There is a kal v'chomer present in all of these questions. And the halacha is, even so, it's not like that. Kal v'chomer states, the garment with tcheles should not need tzitzis. And the halacha is, but it needs tzitzis. And that's life. That's Torah. That's halacha. Kal v'chomer states, the house full of Sifrei Torah shouldn't need a mezuzah. And the answer is, it does. Kal v'chomer states, if he's entirely white, he should be completely tamei. And the answer is, he's not. Says Rabbi Yonasan Eibershitz. So what is Korach saying? He doesn't accept the answers? No, he does accept the answers. And what's his message to Moshe? You can't always rely on a kal v'chomer. doesn't always give you the right answer. Sometimes the real answer is beyond what the Kal Vachomer says. And what is his point? Therefore, your Kal Vachomer was not sufficient basis to break the Luchos. What did you have? You had a Kal Vachomer? I just brought you three examples of cases where there's a Kal Vachomer. But that doesn't mean that the end result is based on the Kal Vachomer. And you based your actions on a Kal Vachomer. That was overreacting, once again. And what all of this is leading towards, therefore, is Korach. And as we see, this really is a second wave. Not only is he claiming that if things change, they can change back. In his own way, he's looking to undermine the fact that Moshe changed things in the first place. And of course, once Moshe changed them, so then Korach is saying, well, look, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu likes you, and if you changed it, so you went along with it. But you never should have done that in the first place. What did you have? A Kal Vachomer? I will meet your Kal Vachomer with three other Kal Vachomers, and none of them work. And neither should yours. This, then, is the platform of Korach. Things should the climate is ripe for the Avodah to come back. Gives us an altogether new appreciation. There's a great deal of depth to what Korach is saying. There's a lot you can say about Korach, but amongst those things is what Chazal say. He was a pikeach. He's very smart, and he knows how to fence in learning. And now, says the Kli Chemda. Once we understand that the basic idea of these 250 men is that the conditions are right for the avoda to return to everyone, and that most of those 250 were bechorim themselves, so they are the obvious candidates. There is something else involved here. As we know, everyone agrees to a certain extent. There's a connection between the kapara for the egel and the mishkan. Now, the two are mentioned together. I mean, you have the mitzvah of the Mishkan, and then the Egel and Kisiso, and then the building of the Mishkan. Now, Rashi says that the Mishkan, in a sense, is a response to the Egel. It's Mishkan Eidos. It's testimony. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings his divine presence back to the Jewish people, that's testimony that fundamentally they've been fulfilled for the Egel. So the cause and effect relationship is symptomatic. It is a sign that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has forgiven the Jewish people. The Sephorno also discusses the relationship between the Egel and the Mishkan. And like Rashi, he understands that the Mishkan comes as a response to the Egel. But he differs from Rashi in one critical point. According to the Sephorno, the relationship between the Egel and the Mishkan is causational. That is to say, the very idea of a Mishkan is a result of the Egel. And what does that mean? Does that mean that had there been no Egel, there would be no Mishkan? Says the Sforno, yes. And the reason why is because had there been no Egel, and this is a very big chiddush of the Sforno, but he goes with it, Le'orech HaDerech, had it not been for the Egel, the Jewish people would not have needed a localized place of avodah in order to have that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rather, anywhere that a person sought to bring a korban, not only, we see how these two things are now going together, not only would the avodah have been spread out amongst the Jewish people in terms of the families, but also geographically it could be spread out. If a person wishes to bring a korban, there isn't anything that you need to do that you would have to go somewhere else in order to do. Your own backyard would have the status of a Mishkan. That's what life was like before the Egel. And that is what we mean when we say, says Sforno, that were not for the Egel, there would be no Mishkan, because you wouldn't need that centralized, focused place. And that is how he explains the Pasuk, which is very interesting, in the end of Parshas Mishpatim, when it's just after Matan Torah, and nothing has gone wrong yet. And the Pasuk states in the end of Mishpatim, it's a well-known Pasuk, Bechol ha-makom asher askir es shemi, avo elecha uberachticha. Wherever you mention my name, I will come to you and bless you. Says the Sforno, what that's saying is that there are no restrictions. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's divine presence is not localized anywhere or not restricted to a specific place. It can be anywhere. Once the climate changed as in the wake of the Chet HaEgel, so there can only be one specific place called the Mishkan, and you need to go there. If that is true, says the Kli Chemda, then we can understand how it is that the test of the Keturas was conducted. That is to say, we had a question. According to a number of Rishonim, there's only one person who brought the Keturas in the right place. That's Aaron. Everybody else brought it outside. And our question was, so then they don't have a chance? Because it has to be brought in the Mishkan. And he's the only one bringing it in the Mishkan. Says the Kli Chemda, but if we understand what Korach is claiming, and his men are claiming, that things should revert to the way they were before the Chet HaEgel, and that therefore the Avodah should revert back to them, then a corollary of that is that conditions for Avodah should also revert to how they were back before the Egel. Namely, it does not have to be done in a specific place. B'chol ha'mokom asher askir ha'shemi avo'elecha ve'erachticha. Wherever you are can be a place of Avodah. And therefore it is part and parcel of their claim. As surely as they're saying that we should be able to do the Avodah as we were able to before, so we should be able to do it where we were able to before, which is anywhere. And that is why they had no inhibitions or no reservations about bringing the Keturas even outside of the Mishkan. Ultimately, their part of their claim is, we don't even need the Mishkan anymore. And of course, that was part of their great mistake. But they did not hesitate to accept the Avodah once we appreciate the full picture of what they mean to claim. So this is a great deal of insight through the Meforshim to understand exactly, and again, here Korach and his men split up. Because Korach, he's not really at one with everything that he's claiming. There's other things going on inside of him. But these 250 men, they really did go for it. I mean, he attracted them in this way because they really did believe it. And in the end, it led to their doom. We should know further. Again, just the more we look at the psukim, the more we draw out. With regards to the test of the Keturas, as we have seen, and as actually happened, it was a very high stakes contest. In the sense that if you lose, you die. And that is a little harsh. In other words, if one may ask the question, and certain Meforshim do ask the question, at the end of the day, especially if these 250 men, if they meant well, leave Korach aside just for the moment, the 250 men, if they really were L'shem Shamayim, misguided, overzealous, little bit overambitious, but if their heart was in the right place, so to devise a test whereby if you lose, the results are fatal, I mean, that seems a little bit extreme. Now, should we ask the question, well, you know, is there any better type of test? Do we have an alternative in mind? So the Maharal Diskin says, yes, actually, I do. And the reason why I do is because there's a parallel situation which was much safer and it proves the point just as well. We refer, of course, to the confrontation at Har HaKarmel between Elio and Nevi Habal. Now they're claiming that they're right, and he's claiming that he's right. So how are we going to prove it? They're looking for a divine intervention, and Elio says, look, you prepare your korban, I'll prepare your korban. Whoever's right, the fire will come down and consume their korban. Now that's much safer, because if you lose, nothing happens. To arrange the test whereby everyone brings fire, and we know already from Nadav and Avihu in Parsha Shmini that if you bring the fire, and you're not meant to, so you will get burnt. Which means to arrange the test in that way means that whoever loses will die. So the moral disc can ask the question for these 250 men, instead of saying, which Moshe does say, put the keteres and put the fire. And good luck. Instead of saying that, just bring the keteres. And whoever is the real one, the fire will come down. No harm done. The point is just as emphatically made. And 250 men could go home at the end of the day. It's an interesting shaila. And moreover, according to a certain Mefarshim, this is exactly what the Jewish people are saying to Moshe in the beginning of Perek Yud Zayin. The 250 men have been killed, and Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Vav, states, Vayilonu, kol adas bnei Yisrael mimacharas, the day after that, they started complaining. Al Moshe val Aaron lemor, atem hamitem esam Hashem, you killed God's people. That's day two. We would have thought that the matter would have been settled on day one. And they're still complaining on day two. Atem amitem esam Hashem. And should we ask the question, well, what does that mean? They were in the wrong. And they knowingly engaged in this test. And they suffered from it. Why is Moshe being accused of killing them? Except the answer is, according to these Mefarshim, the charge is you killed them by making the test fatal. If you would have made it benign, and if you're not the one, so you get a rap on the knuckles, so then they would still be alive. But you coordinated the test in a way that if you lose, you lose your life. So you killed them. Atem amitem esam Hashem. Why'd you make the test fatal? But what's interesting is, you know, after the when we appreciate the question, to look at the psukim. And when we do, we'll see something very interesting. We begin in Perek Tet Zayin, Pasuk Zayin. They come to Moshe and they say, we all want the avoda. And Moshe says, fine. Pasuk Vav of Perek Tet Zayin, Zos asu kechu lachem machtos, Korach v'chol adosu. So take the pans. Ustenu bahen esh. Put fire, v'simulim ketores, and ketores, a recipe for disaster, if you're not the right one. V'fnei Hashem machar. V'haya isha she'ivchar Hashem hu ha-kadosh. Okay, no question about it. Now what's interesting is, if we go now to Pasuk Yud Zayin, when it's the time is for the test, it says, ukuchu ish machtaso, Unisatem alehem keteres. Everybody take the machta, take the pan, and put on them keteres. V'kravtem lifnei Hashem ish machtaso. So at the time that it actually happens, there is no mention of fire. Interesting. Then what happens? Pasuk Yudches, v'ikru ish machtaso, v'yitnu alehem esh, v'yasim alehem keteres. They take the machtos, they put the fire, and they put the keteres. So basically, this test has been referred to three times. The day before, fire plus ketores. On the time, just ketores, and when it happens, fire plus ketores. What is the meaning of all of this? It says the Maral Diskin, and it's a fascinating part of the story to consider. Moshe Rabbeinu's job originally, when the 250 men come, and say we want the avoda, Moshe Rabbeinu's job, or his goal, is to dissuade them. That's all. To convince them that it's not really in their interest to be going after the avoda, if it's not for them. And the chiddush of the Maral Diskin is that Moshe Rabbeinu was sure that after suggesting the test of the Keteres plus fire equals 250 out of 251 will not survive, he was convinced that they would back down. His job was to deter them, not to test them. As far as Moshe Rabbeinu is concerned, he didn't realize how locked into to this agenda they were. So the result that Moshe was hoping for was to say, they said, we want the Avodah. And Moshe says, okay, come back tomorrow with fire. And as soon as they hear fire and Keteres in the same sentence, they'd have meetings the next day and wouldn't be able to make it. So that's why he mentions fire originally, because he doesn't want them to do it. He wants them to realize just how dangerous it is to be involved in the Avodah, if it's not for them. Lo and behold, and no one is more surprised than Moshe, they all turn up the next day. If they're really serious, no one is turning back. So Moshe modifies the test. He takes the fire out of the test. If they're really going to go through with it, he doesn't want them to get hurt. And he changes the rules of the test to make it fire friendly. Take the Keteres. Isn't that a better way? But for the 250 men, it's too late. In other words, they are so focused on and intent on doing the Avodah, and so convinced each one is it that they will survive, that they refuse to have the gloves put on. But rather, they say, no, yesterday we said fire. Fire it is. And that's why in the event they took the fire, Moshe Rabbeinu tried to delete the fire from the equation of the test, they wouldn't hear of it. And then it killed them. So a great deal of their will, which on the one hand fueled a very L'shem Shamayim goal, was ultimately what killed them. Because they would not back down from any of the way that the test was originally set up. And that was their undoing. So this is the comment of the Maral Diskin, and again, the closer we look at the Psukim without glossing over things, the more dimensions come out. Now, I would like to spend just the final few moments discussing some people who are, they're key figures in the story of Korach, and they're not really mentioned, they're not spoken about in Parshas Korach until later on. Namely, Korach's children. And it isn't until Parshas Pinchas that we hear Ubnei Korach lo mesu. Korach's own sons didn't die. Everybody else did, the 250 men, Dathan and Aviram, and Korach himself. Ubnei Korach lo mesu. Originally, they were with their father. They were on his team. And at a certain point, they changed sides. And they did tshuva. That we know. So that they were spared. The question is, when did they do tshuva? And what form did their tshuva take? And the answer to this question is staggering. Because the Medrash Tehillim tells us, and of course Medrash Tehillim discusses Bnei Korach a lot because they were actually authors of a number of the Tehillim. Lam Natzeach Lebnei Korach, this morning Shir Shayom, Shir Mizmor Lebnei Korach. I mean, from that ill-fated group of Adas Korach, they rose to great things and became co-authors of Tehillim. And in Tehillim Perek Mem Hei, which begins Lamanateach HaShoshanim Bnei Korach, the pasuk states, Rachash libi davar tov. Rachash libi, in my heart, I had a good thought. What does that mean? Rachash libi davar tov. The Medrash Tehillim explains, Lahodiacha. When is it referring to that they had a good thought? What was the good thought? Lahodiacha, shelo yochlu lehisvados befihem. That they were in a situation that they could not actually say vidui verbally. I mean, that's a classic tshuva. Ashamnu, bagadnu. They couldn't even speak. All they had was what they felt in their hearts. Elakevan sherachash libam b'tshuva, but as soon as they had only had thoughts of tshuva in their hearts, kiblam hakadosh baruch hu. Hashem accepted their tshuva and they were spared. Says the Medrash Tehillim, v'chein b'nei Korach lo hayu yucholim lo mashira b'fiyim. They couldn't actually say anything. Ela rochash libam b'tshuva, they had tshuva in their hearts, u'miyad kiblam. V'lama lo hayucholun lo mashira b'fihim. Why couldn't they say shira? Why couldn't they say anything positive? The answer, says the Medrash, is she'ol mitachteihem. Because if you were where they were, you also probably wouldn't be able to say much. The depths were open in front of them. The ground had already opened. Ve'esh melahetes vivoseihem. There's fire all around them, as it says. Ve'esh yotzim es Hashem. Tiftach eretz vativ ladason. Vayu b'nei Korach ro'en she'ol pesucha mikan. So they saw the she'ol, the depths open in right beneath them. Ve'esh mikan, fire on all sides. So they were a little bit overcome. They were dumbstruck. They couldn't say anything. They couldn't speak. And that's why all they had was what was in their hearts. Says the Be'er Yosef, there is a great deal we can learn about tshuva from Bnei Korach. They teach us all we need to know. Number one, From what type of avera can a person do tshuva? As we know from Parshas Korach, it doesn't get that much worse than Korach. Korach accused Moshe of fabricating the Torah for purposes of promoting his brother. That is kfira, absolutely. And originally they were part of that. So, in answer to the first question, is from what type of avera can a person recover? The answer is, if they could recover from that, anyone can recover from anything. That's number one. Number two, what does it need? What does it take? Of course, there are many branches to tshuva, and there's many stages to tshuva, but none of them are a substitute for that moment of rachash libita bar tov, or just the fundamental realization that a person needs to change. That's all they had, and it was enough. Given the circumstances, it was enough. And number three, until what stage can a person do tshuva? And the answer to that is, well, where were they? The ground had already opened up. The fire was already on all sides. And one may have intuited that, and now it's too late. You had your chance, and now it's too late. And it wasn't too late until they fell. It was an instantaneous decision, but it wasn't too late.
Why only them?
And this teaches us actually a further chiddush. In other words, the more we find out about Korach's sons, the more we find out about Korach. That is to say, that the more we see how this is it's a thought, it's a change of heart at the last moment. And our question is, and who wouldn't have a change of heart at that time? And the answer is Korach and those 250 men. The more we find out about just how late in the day it was, the more we appreciate how absolutely locked into their agenda Korach and his men were, to the extent that even at that stage, and if that stage was good enough for Korach and his sons to do tshuva, that means that even at that stage, Korach wasn't doing tshuva. And that is actually a very frightening picture of how tunneled a person can become in their way, that even at that final stage, there's no backing down. And what's fascinating alongside all of this is, what does Moshe Rabbeinu say here? He says in Pasuk Lamed, here we are, Perek Tet Zayin, Pasuk Lamed. And this, it seems, is Moshe Rabbeinu's initiative. I mean, he doesn't consult with HaKadosh Baruch Hu about this. V'imbriya yivro Hashem. If Hashem creates something new, ufotzeso hadama espia, and the ground opens its mouth, uvola osam eskol asher lahem, and swallows them up and all they have, v'yarduchayim she'ola, alive into the grave, so then you'll know that I was right. That's very specific. The first thing he said is if they just die of natural causes, so then I'm wrong. But if this happens, then they're wrong. But it's very, very specific. And also, if we may say, it's also very extreme. I mean, there isn't really there's no pleasant way for a person to leave the world, but to be buried alive. And that's exactly what Moshe is saying. In no uncertain terms, he dictates every single aspect of what has happened to them. V'yardu chayim she'ola. Why? Says Reuven Margolius, in the Sefer Margolius Hayam, Masechah Sanhedrin, this, in a sense, is the greatest chiddush of all. Moshe Rabbeinu, if they do not back down, so then there is no choice because they are undermining the entire Torah. There is no greater crime. But Moshe Rabbeinu wants them to have every single possibility to do tshuva. And that's why he doesn't say, let them just drop down dead. He says, let them go down chayim, alive. Why? Because he wants them to stay alive, even as the ground opens up, in order to allow them to do tshuva, as in fact Korach's sons did. And that's actually amazing, because as Moshe is setting up the way things will work, part of what's going on in his mind is, how far can I push things in order to give them every chance absolutely to do tshuva? And this is the answer. So foremost in Moshe's mind is, because who wouldn't do tshuva? Now, historically, looking back, the answer is most of them. But once again, for Moshe, they must do tshuva at that stage. And that's why I'm going to set it up this way. They'll realize they made a mistake. They made a mistake. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will accept the tshuva. And none of this has to happen. V'yodu chayim she'ola. And once again, Moshe was surprised at the obstinacy of Korach, that even as they went down alive, there was no turning back and there was no change of heart. It turns out, if one may add just as a postscript, that what got Korach going, as we saw in the Medrash at the beginning, was the Paraduma. He saw the Paraduma, the red cow was a green light. And off he goes to contest Moshe. But actually, if we may say with reservations, Korach never really saw the Paraduma. What he saw in the Paraduma is the result, that it's a kapara for the Chet Egel. Quite true. But the reason why the Paraduma is a kapara for the Egel is because the Paraduma is a chok. It's the point where you say, this is beyond my understanding. I would have done things differently, but nobody asked me. And that's why it's a kapara for the Egel, because the Chet Egel, at its root, was the Jewish people. In the absence of Moshe Rabbeinu, they took things into their own hands. They went to Aaron. Instead of asking him what to do, they told him what to do. And now the ball is in their hands. They will dictate national policy and their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, regardless of what Aaron says. And anyone who gets in their way was killed, as was Hor, and as would have been Aaron. That's the problem with the Egel. And that's why the Paraduma is the antidote. Because Paraduma is I give up. I don't know. I don't know what it's about, and I do what I'm told. So there's a very deep irony here. Korach was emboldened by the Paraduma to take issue with Moshe, but in so doing, he actually reverted from the Paraduma back to the Chet Egel, because he took an Egel-like mentality, inspired by the Paraduma, to say, now that everything's okay, all the problem with the Egel has been cleared up. So I'm contesting what Moshe said. And that was exactly the very issue that got them into trouble with the Egel in the first place. And that is the moral of the story of Parshas Korach. There's so much to learn from Korach. He's not there just to make us feel good that, you know, we'll never be as bad as Korach. He's there to learn from a lesson in stubbornness, a lesson in what a person says versus what a person really wants, a lesson in machlokas, l'shem shamayim, and all of these things. And what's interesting is, as the Mefarshim point out, we take a lesson from Korach every year. Just before we blow the shofar, there's a perek of Tehillim that we say seven times, and it's authored by B'nai Korach. It's the last thing we say going into the shofar. And the Sefer Shiras David explains, because by this stage, if you were 5 minutes away from blowing the shofar, so B'nai Korach are your role models. Because at this stage, it's the 11th hour. And the only thing that stops a person from hearing the sound of the shofar is to be like Korach, as if to say, come what may, I've charted my course. And therefore, we just get a reminder, a few times over, remember B'nai Korach. Don't make the mistake that Korach made. Take the inspiration from what his sons did. So when the shofar sounds in a few minutes' time, that's the time of Rachashli B'davar Tov, and that, in a sense, is the ultimate lesson for everyone prior to the shofar. That's the lesson from Korach. We'll leave it over there for this evening.